Hello, welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. I'm John Burns, and this is my podcast for folk who like to be outdoors, really. It's a fantastic time of year up here in the Highlands. Autumn is one of my favourite times of year, and the colours of the trees are just turning now, really beautiful. The only downside really with the Highlands is that unfortunately the trees don't tend to keep those colours very long, because there's usually a fairly spirited wind comes along and strips them. But it's nevertheless an amazing time of year, and it's sort of the herald of winter for me. It's a great time to go walking, and my guest today is, I have to say, he's a repeat offender on outside in podcast. He's I've already interviewed him about his first book, and I'm going to talk to him today about his second book, which is the sequel, I guess, and it's about an amazing walk. I mean, I have to say, a real feat of endurance, but more than that, I think it has to be a real adventure. So my guest today is Andrew Terrell, and he's here to talk about his book On Sacred Ground, and he's walked over 7,000 miles, I think, which is going in some. Hello, Andrew, how are you?
Hi, John, I'm good. I'm in Colorado, so I'm still waking up at the time we're recording this, whereas you're probably ready for bed almost, or at least for a Scottish whiskey or something.
not quite yet. It's a little early.
You might be ready for a whiskey after talking to me.
I'm sure that won't be the case. I'm sure. So you're in Colorado. Tell us about your first book. Was The Earth Beneath My Feet, wasn't it? That was the first section of your walk. Is that correct?
It was, yes. So I've written two books about my journey from Calabria to the top of Norway, which may seem a little, self-centered to think that a single walk was worth two books. But, you know, it was a long journey. It lasted for 17 and a half months, more or less. And it was so intense while I was doing it, so immersive, that in some ways, the only honest way to share it would be to write a book about every single day, because, you know, a lot happens when you're in the mountains and when you're somewhere new. So when I began writing the story of the journey, I originally thought, I'm going to write a book about it, because it was a story I had to tell because of the experiences and what I learned from it. And as I was writing it, I realized that if it was just one book, it was going to be so epic, no one would be able to lift it up. It would be heavier than the backpack I carried across Europe if I just kept it as one volume. So when I'd finished writing the story, I saw that it broke apart pretty well into two sections. And so it ended up, becoming two books, which each have a slightly different, you know, slant to them, and each tell a complete story in itself. Like, you don't have to read the second book if you've read the first one. But obviously, I hope people will. By the same token, I've written the second one in a way that you can pick it up and get enough of a recap from the first journey, why I'm there, that, you know. So,
can I ask you, what inspired you to do this walk? I mean, it's a massive investment of time, if nothing else, isn't it? That has to be a life-changing experience. Why did you just think, I'll walk from there and end up in the Arctic Circle, the northern tip of Norway, and you even continued on to an island, I think, didn't you? It's like you couldn't stop.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. You couldn't stop is a good way of summing it up. So the motivations behind it are explored in a lot more detail in the books. At the time I didn't understand them fully. I didn't understand our instinctive drive to connect with nature, because while the planet is what made us who we are, you know, hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution in direct contact with nature, and then in the last 300 especially, we've cut ourselves off from that. Which is why when we step into nature, we feel this great soaring set of emotions, because we're finally home in the place that made us. You know, we don't just go into the mountains for pretty views or for exercise or to escape. We go there to become whole again, which is how I see it now. But at the time, I didn't. At the time, I just knew I didn't like being in suburban London, especially. I hated being tied to the routine of a 9-to-5 job. I didn't like my boss. I was a stammerer back then. I struggled in, you know, encounters with people. But when I stepped into the mountains, I was free to be myself because there was no one to talk to. You know, you pass other walkers and you say, "Hi, how's it going?" And then, you know, then you move on. And I could manage that as a stammerer. But so I went to the mountains because I loved being in the mountains for reasons I didn't understand. And I loved the fact that I could be myself and challenged. But I discovered that going to the hills for weekends away or for, you know, 2 week annual holidays wasn't enough because I would get into this wonderful place of connection, but then I'd have to go back to work and back to the routine and the, you know, the grind of living indoors with carpet underfoot and concrete, you know, on the pavements outside. And so I wanted a longer journey that was something that felt more like a way of life than just a simple holiday.
I think that's an important point when you say that it became a way of life, because it must have been an existence, such a singular sort of existence that I guess the, well, can we even call it the real world? I don't know. But the world that you described with work and concrete must have felt after a while a very alien place.
It did, yes. It did. Eventually, I think by the time I reached Germany, which would have been January, so I'd been underway for, I don't know, 8-9 months by that point, I kind of reached a point where I felt I was looking at the human world from the outside. You know, all the people in the villages I passed through, their lives revolved around, you know, normal human things: waking up, going to work, taking the kids to school, going to the supermarket, whatever. But for me, I kind of felt like, it all sounds so pretentious now, looking back at it. Now I'm back in civilization and have been for decades. It felt like I was, you know, a creature of the world looking in at the human world and finally seeing it for what it really was, just a little outpost, whereas the real world was, you know, going along besides that and, you know, not even connected to that. Like I was looking at things finally in the real way for the first time.
And a walk like that you did for so many months must basically create its own sort of rhythm of life, I guess, does it?
Yeah, it felt like an entirely separate life within a life, if that makes sense. You know, it seemed kind of unconnected in some ways to my previous existence before it. And so, you know, family and friends and the job and everything back in suburban London almost didn't belong to me anymore. It was something that someone else had lived that I might have read about or seen a television documentary about, and because it was so long and become so, you know, immersed in the day-by-day walking life, that's the only thing that seems relevant and seems to matter.
And so obviously you must have had a huge amount of experiences on something like that. What were the low points for you? Because that doing that something like that is as much a mental challenge as it is physical, really.
For sure, yes. Possibly, I mean, there were lots of challenges, physical and mental. Probably the greatest mental challenge occurred in autumn, as autumn was slipping into winter, because I just spent 6 wonderful summer months walking the length of Italy. And you know, walking in summer is incredible, and lots of people do 6-month hikes, you know, along the Pacific Crest Trail or the Appalachian Trail or, journeys like that. But most through hikers, as Americans call them here, long distance walkers back there, tend to finish their journeys before winter hits. And so they go back home. And that's what I'd done. I'd done one, you know, I'd done a 6 month walk meandering through the Alps to see as much of the range as I could. And I'd done a 3 month walk in the Pyrenees and everything had been fine. I hadn't been lonely once. But after 6 months of travel, as the days started to grow shorter and the temperatures colder and the ice built up on the tent every single night, and I realized I still had a whole year pretty much to go on my own, suddenly loneliness began to hit. Because, you know, I realized I was going to spend Christmas alone and my birthday alone, and I'd be camping in the snow for the next 5, 6, 7, 8 months, as it turned out. And loneliness wasn't something I'd expected to be a challenge, because from my 6 month journeys, I thought I can cope with my own company in the mountains. It's what I want. And so it was interesting to suddenly realize and discover that actually, as a human being, as a social creature, because that's what we are, we've become the successful species, too successful, some might argue, the successful species we are because we work together, because we support one another, because we share stories and communicate and grow as a multitude coming together as one. And I'd separated myself from that and was finally seeing that actually that was unnatural to be that, no matter how much I wanted to be on my own because of my stammer and my shyness and my social dysfunction as I then was. And so realizing that, and being aware that I still had, you know, a year or so on my own, was so uncomfortable. On a couple of occasions, it set me into a panic attack of loneliness where I couldn't even, it was my brain almost short fused, as it were. It happened the first time towards the end of the first book, when one of my brothers and a friend of his came to join me on the trail for a week, and I had a week of laughter and company and everything was amazing. And then suddenly when they left and I was back on my own again, I fell into this black pit of loneliness that was so terrible I didn't know what to do with myself. And on that occasion, eventually the mountains, the Dolomites in the Italian Alps, kind of pulled me back from the brink. But because of how scary it was, I didn't even really want to think about, you know, being on my own again. I didn't want to explore what was going on and why it was going on. And it finally hit again on Christmas Day itself, which is in the second book. Christmas for me had always been, from my earliest memories, the most magical time of year, because the family all came together and it was an exciting celebration of companionship and, yes, presents and good food and all that stuff. But it was the companionship, I think. And suddenly, by choice, I was spending Christmas Day in a horrible, dark, drippy, foggy forest. And so going through that whole process of having to deal with being alone and really realizing it, ended up being the beast that could potentially have broken my journey.
Because you talk about, you've got a connection with nature, obviously, which is, you know, really important to both myself and you. But I think what you would also do, you were doing it in a very unnatural way, really, because I always think one of the things about camping, for example, which is really nice about it, it's nice to have that base where you've other people and you feel safe. And the surrounding around you might be maybe dark and intimidating, but you've got this little cocoon. You didn't have any of that, really.
Yeah, I just had me and my stinky old tent and my dirty walking socks. And, you know, in some ways, the journey became a search for balance. I didn't think of it as a search for balance or a search for anything when I set off. I just wanted to spend time in my mountains for as long as I could. But it became like a search for, I guess, a search for understanding of what I needed in life, and then a search for balance. And, you know, we as people need people around us, but we also need that connection with nature. And so it kind of became a journey to understanding that. And I think eventually, because of the mental trauma around the Christmas period, I ended up seeing my place in the world so differently. I saw that the wild was our natural home, but I saw that people and civilization and society and friends and strangers and encounters was as important a part of life as, you know, being able to step outside onto the unpaved earth and knowing, even if I didn't have it going forwards, I knew that at some point in the future I would. It's kind of like food, right? If you have a nice breakfast, you don't have to worry about your next meal because you know typically that you're going to be able to eat lunch eventually. It was kind of the same with people. I realized that even though I didn't have people now, I knew it was almost guaranteed at some point in life there would be people in my life again, probably. And it made being alone, realizing that, eventually made being alone easier to accept and deal with. And ultimately, I felt like I kind of won a victory against loneliness that means still that loneliness is never going to come back again, no matter what situation that I find myself in. Because until I take my last breath, it's almost guaranteed that I'm going to have people to be with at some point.
And obviously, having been through what you've been through, you know that you can cope. Well, what was it difficult in the sense, or was it challenging in a way that went, because as you got, you know, you've been walking for over a year and you find yourself getting into Norway, which I associate with being remote and rugged and wild and wet and also a sort of brooding place in some ways. Did it get more extreme as you got up to Norway, or is that nonsense?
No, not nonsense at all. Norway is Scotland on steroids.
Ah, yeah.
The mountains are bigger. You might think no place could be wetter than the west coast of the Highlands, but Norway does a good attempt at it. The Atlantic North Sea fronts are constantly crashing against the mountains and the fjells and the plateau up there. When I reached Norway, it was spring still. I didn't start walking up Norway until the middle of April, but I arrived there was a week of heavy snow to greet me. I was thinking around the corner. And I ended up walking on snow pretty much until early July.
Wow, really? Okay.
So from April until, you know, July, there was a lot of rain and a lot of fog and a lot of deep, soft, mushy snow. And you can imagine, you know, walking across the Cairngorm Plateau.
Snow,
and the clouds are down and the snow is so soft that even when you're wearing snowshoes, you're sinking a foot into it. And Norway has hundreds of thousands of freshwater lakes dotted around the mountains.
Right.
When they're all covered in snow and when the fog's down and everything's, but it's warm and everything's soft, weaving across this landscape where you feel like, and you have, you know, I wasn't very good at traveling light, so I had a 60-pound plus rucksack on my back. You think, well, if I step onto a lake with this thing and it's all thawing,
yes,
it's not going to go well. So it was physically grueling to snowshoe across this environment.
Yeah. Snowshoeing is hard work at the best of times, isn't it?
It really is genuinely draining. And also it was mentally intimidating because of the risks that weren't just in my mind. You know, the soft snow on steep ground can avalanche and spread.
And if
you step onto a river that's raging, but it's buried beneath snow, and you break through a snow bridge, you know, that's a real issue. Norway was challenging for so many levels, despite everything I'd learned leading up to that point, you know, about being able to deal with myself and the reasons for why I was on that walk and feeling like I belonged in nature. Norway, southern Norway especially, kind of taught me that belonging in nature only went so far. No matter what I wanted, which was, you know, to be this happy, elated hiker wandering, you know, merrily through the mountains, it turned out that, you know, I couldn't hide from reality in those mountains. There was a point where I had to be realistic and practical, and I accepted that I needed to follow a route that was lower and not in quite the good style. That I wanted to follow a high-level mountain route all the way. And if I'd have done that, I would have been exhausted, you know, long before I reached journey's ends. So I had to retreat on several occasions and follow a valley path instead.
Okay.
Which was, you know, eventually coming to accept, you know, the world for what it really is, not for what I wanted it to be, and accepting myself and my and understanding that actually I was less of a mountain hiker than I thought I should be. And I think coming to terms with ourselves, with our limitations, you know, is, I think it's an essential part of life. And rather than beating yourself up for the reality of who you are, accepting it and then moving on and making the best of it is an essential life lesson to learn.
Yeah, one of the things I wonder, and on a very practical level, how did you manage to carry enough food to keep going?
I just carried it. I didn't. The longest point between resupply towns was up in the Arctic in Sweden, where I had, it was 2.5 weeks potentially. I crammed food into my backpack that I called 10 ton, because carrying it felt like, you know, I was carrying being massaged by a 10 ton forklift truck. And I wasn't a lightweight backpacker. Gear was heavier 25 years ago when I did this journey anyway. But I also liked to read in camp, so I carry paperback books. SLR camera, because taking photography. Taking pictures is part of being in the mountains for me. And I also wanted to eat fresh food on my journey. So, you know, even though I was hiking in for 2+ weeks, I had an apple for every day and a bunch of vegetables to throw in my evening stew and packets of biscuits. It wasn't just dehydrated stuff. My load was monstrous, absolutely ridiculous, embarrassing when I look at the pictures today, because, you know, like backpackers doing the Appalachian Trail or whatever have packs that look like, you know, it's pretty much like a loaf of bread on their back. It's crazy. Whereas mine looks like I'm in some kind of masochistic pursuit to prove how ridiculously strong I am. Whatever it was, it wasn't what I do now, but at the time it's what I did.
Well, I think as you say, with the kind of equipment that was available then, and you were walking through winter, quite difficult to be lightweight if you're doing those sort of distances as well.
Lots of lightweight backpackers are discovering that lightweight gear doesn't last as long and it isn't as robust as they'd like it to be, even though it's three times as expensive as some of the older gear. Yeah. I needed strong gear that would go the distance for sure. I could have traveled lighter. I just made my own choices. But carrying it's interesting, because I didn't actually address the weight of the backpack that much in my stories. Looking back now, partly I think because it's just plain embarrassment at how heavy the load was. But I think in some ways it was kind of a weird self-inflicted penance.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I wanted something. Deep down, it sounds so, again, too much navel gazing, and I don't really live my life navel gazing. I really don't. But I wanted to feel that I was earning the rewards that the journey gave me, and carrying a heavy pack made the journey much more of a labor than it might have been, which meant. Peculiarly, strangely, the rewards were greater because of it.
You did walk 7,000 miles, you know. That's probably enough for most people, I would think.
But the other thing the big pack did was it slowed me down. It meant I might stop every hour just to sit and have a bite to eat and look at the view and ease my
shoulders.
And it meant I didn't walk in a, you know, 30 miles a day the way some people do now. There were some big days up to 30 miles, but the average mileage when walking was probably only 13 or 14 miles a day. And I think going slowly helped me connect to the land more than it would have done if I'd moved through it swiftly. Yeah, and I don't say that to knock people who go fast at all, because that's a perfectly valid experience, and you gain so much from doing that. It's just a different approach. So the weight of my pack didn't detract from the journey. I think it only added to it, despite the difficulties of a 140-pound skinny person carrying a pack that at its heaviest, I was shocked. So in northern Sweden, on that long stretch I mentioned, in the Padjelanta National Park, which is an incredible place, probably the best place I walked on the journey for so many reasons, I've ended up joining a couple of German lads who were out for 2 weeks, and they were horrified, shocked, bemused by the side of 10 ton on my back. And when we got to a Swedish mountain hut, which had a scale hanging outside of it, they said, "Can we weigh your pack? We're really fascinated to see what it is."
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, "I don't really want to know. let's not bother." But they insisted. So we finally took two of us to heave it onto the scale. And I'd already been underway by that point, I think, for 5 days. So I'd already eaten the bulk of the food. And the pack was 86 pounds.
Wow, that's a fair old pack. Wow.
And I was 140 pounds in those days. So it was more than the maximum, you know, a third of your body weight that the outdoor instructors always talk about, or used to. Now they're even less than that. Despite that, I still wouldn't, I would do it differently now, but looking back, I'm so glad I did what I did, because it made the journey what it was.
Yeah, yeah. I was joking before about, you know, how you couldn't stop, but actually, how difficult was it to stop? Because your whole life had basically changed, hadn't it? And you know, you've got a very, well, I suppose one of the things about that sort of life on walking is that life is actually very simple, because you know what you're going to do that day, and it dictates a sort of rhythm to you. So how did you find coming back into the, well, I don't know if it's the real world or not really, but the world of the world of concrete and jobs, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting topic that seems to come up a lot now, because people talk about post-trip depression.
Yeah.
It seems to be a common thing. But, and it's true, at the time when I was on the journey, like who I was so closely linked to what I was doing and how I was living. And the simplicity, as you say, is one of those things that really is one of the attractions of living out of a backpack with, you know, just such a simple, uncluttered, free life. And then, yes, when you finish, you have to go back to the human world. Let's call it the human world, not the real world, because I think the real world is a balance of the two. That's the real world.
Yeah,
where you have the human world and you have forays into nature, which are a habit, a part of it. It was emotional as I was approaching the end. I was ready for the end because I was tired after carrying my rucksack so long and walking for 18 months. So I was physically ready for the end. And I was looking forward to being back with my parents and my brothers and my family. And I was looking forward to some comforts again after all that time. But at the same time, I was almost in mourning because I'd fallen in love with Northern Norway, with the Arctic. Falling in love isn't an exaggeration. I was besotted with everything I found up there. And the second book really leads to the climax. The resolution of the story is based upon what being up there meant. And I don't think we have time to go into detail to just talk about that here, because I don't think it would mean anything without the story that leads.
No, without the context, yeah.
But I'd found something very special, and I mourned finishing the journey and leaving it and losing it. But I think what I ultimately found, and I think I kind of realized this as I was approaching the end, was that what I'd found was not an external thing, but I carried it inside. Every single memory, every single experience.
Oh, right. Okay. I see what you're saying.
Every single encounter, every single lesson had now become a part of who I was, and I was going to take that back to civilization. And physically the journey might end, but the real journey that counted, which is life itself, was just going to go on. And all those lessons, all those experiences, would mean nothing if I went back to the suburbs and suddenly felt miserable and sorry for myself again. They would count for nothing. The real trick in the journey was finding ways to apply the lessons from the wild and the lessons from all the experiences to the human world and make the human world an ongoing part of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got back, that kind of became the challenge to apply the most basic lessons. Like, on the journey, I didn't always live up to my own expectations. For example, I didn't follow that high route I wanted.
Yeah.
I ended up walking in the valley. But sometimes I took the easy option. You know, I the weather was awful. I stayed in the tent all day. In Italy, there was a big mountain range I desperately wanted to cross, but for some reason I felt intimidated. So I skirted it. I went around the mountains, took the easy option. And I realized on the journey that no matter what had come before, every single morning when I woke up, I had yet another chance for that day to be the best day possible, to try again to be the best version of myself. And I realized that applied back in the suburbs of London. You know, this daily mantra, waking up every day, today I have yet another chance to be who I want to be, no matter what's gone before. And just that simple thing is such an empowering, life-changing lesson from the trail to carry into normal life. And there were a handful of lessons, so many lessons, in fact, like that, that meant that when I got back to the suburbs of London, there was no post-trail depression. There was just an excitement to get on with life and make it count and keep moving forwards, even though I wasn't moving forwards physically. But of course, aside from all that pretentious rubbish, I also knew that long walks were what I did. So as soon as I got back, I started planning for the next one.
Oh dear. Having seen the book and having heard you talk about it, it is quite incredible. I think it's an incredible achievement, and I think it's clear that you learn as much about life as you did about walking from this, and that kind of shines through the books, really. So I think so. And so basically, I would getting towards the end of our show. So basically, your two books. This is your second book, On Sacred Ground. Sounds an amazing read, and thanks very much for talking to me.
Thank you for having me back, John. Thank you. I hope you enjoy that whiskey now.
Not just yet, maybe later. Thanks very much then. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was Andrew Terrell talking about his new book, On Sacred Ground. An amazing achievement, not only to complete the walk, but to write such a powerful and thought-provoking book. If you've enjoyed this little podcast, do give me a little follow on Amazon Podcasts or whatever you use, really. And just to a gentle little plug, my latest book, The Hot Tent Diaries, all about my journeys in the Highlands in a hot tent. That's a tent with a stove. Is available right now as a single paperback and three bite-sized e-books for those of you who like to read on the train, really. Anyway, I do hope you've enjoyed this. I've enjoyed talking to you. I've been John Burns, and I'll be back soon. I hope you are too. Bye-bye.